Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Langani, here with Adrian Nicholson. We've got another great episode for you today. Thanks for joining us. We started previously with Peter Lynch's rules. We're going to continue. I'm really excited about that. Adrian, first, before we start out, how's your last week or 2 weeks been since we haven't been recording every 2 weeks now?
Yeah, everything's good on my end. Feeling great. Back to our regular scheduled programming after recording our 200th episode. So ready to get back to it.
Excellent. That sounds great. So Adrian, why don't you lead us off?
Yeah, so I'd be happy to. So this is part two of Peter Lynch's Golden Rules. If you want to check out the first 13 rules, it's episode 199. You won't have to scroll too far to find it. And we're going to dive into the other golden rules today. And I'm really looking forward to what your take is on some of these rules. I think they're going to be very helpful and a great discussion we're going to have today, Roshan.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, awesome. So like I mentioned in episode 199, we named off and talked about 13 rules. So we're going to start off with rule 14 today. And I'm going to start off by just describing and reading it. And then I'd love to hear what your take is on it, Roshan. So here we go. Rule 14. If you invest $1,000 in a stock, all you can lose is $1,000, but you stand to gain $10,000 or even $50,000 over time if you are patient. The average person can concentrate on a few good companies while the fund manager is forced to diversify. By owning too many stocks, you lose this advantage of concentration. It only takes a handful of big winners to make a lifetime of investing worthwhile.
Yeah, I think this is a great one. Actually, this is one that the investment world talks a lot about. And I'm sure, and so I'm going to summarize it. It's really concentrating. So concentrating into a few investments versus diversifying. I'm going to compare that to owning the index, right? And we'll talk a lot about that today, stocks and indexes. For everyone listening, as we always tell you, this is not investment advice. If you need investment advice, please seek a professional. Adrian and I are here to here to help. This is just to get you thinking about your investments in your portfolio. So concentration versus diversification. I've heard a couple things about it. I wish I could name the source, but it's something that I've heard so frequently that I couldn't tell you who it is. But first, concentration can make you wealthy. Diversification keeps you wealthy is what I've heard. So I think first, it's definitely important to note where you are in your life, in your investment journey to start. Second, what I found is that most but not all great investors concentrate. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But the first is, I mentioned earlier, there's a debate in the investment world with concentration versus diversification. So you've got the extreme people that will believe fully in the efficient market hypothesis. And that says the markets are fully efficient. So at all times, every stock price that's out there is what it is because it incorporates all publicly available information. And what you'll find a lot of great investors will counter that, and they'll say the markets are mostly efficient, not 100% fully efficient. And when you can find those rare inefficiencies, that's when you want to make a significant investment or concentrate your portfolio. Actually, as we're talking about this and we're talking about great investors, I talk about Warren Buffett a lot. It can be noted today that of his publicly owned stocks, he's got about 40% of his portfolio in just Apple. So, that's really heavily concentrated. He famously had the majority of his portfolio in American Express, and I believe that was in the 70s with the saltwater scandal. So that's just an example of concentrating. When I say most great investors concentrate, another book I really like, You Too Could Be a Stock Market Genius by Joel Greenblatt, he talks a lot about owning 5 to 7 stocks in there in the portfolio. Now, there's some more rules that I'll talk about having the right temperament. But for me, this rule number 14 about concentration of your portfolio really is an important one with temperament. When you have that few number of holdings, you'll have a lot more volatility. That's just the name of the game. Just because you have less stocks, they're going to bounce around more on a day-to-day basis. So you've got to make sure you've got the temperament to hold. What I found personally, we're going to talk about this with his additional rules about doing research and analysis. What I found is when I've done the homework, when I've researched a stock, then at that point, to me, the market will do what it does in the short run. It'll bounce around. It does not affect me at all. If there are instances where I have not done the homework, or I'm looking at what other people have done, or I've done most but not all of the homework to feel comfortable, or even when I just own the indexes, I find those are the times where the volatility bothers me the most. So to me, to build the temperament to handle the volatility, that comes from doing the homework of understanding the businesses. And then if the business has not changed, but the markets have just moved that day negatively, you know, that doesn't bother me. So I think this is a great rule. But once again, my points were: know where you are in your investment life, know your comfort level and temperament as you make this decision, whether you want to concentrate or diversify your portfolio.
Yes, all great points. And the only thing I would add would just be the first part of the sentence where it says, if you invest $1,000 in a stock, all you can lose is $1,000. I think that's a great way sometimes to look at it as well. Some people may look at that number and say, hey, you know, that's fine. If I lose $1,000 on this stock, I don't really care. I'll just move on, find the next one. Some people may see that and say, hey, I'm not willing to take on that type of risk. That can really show who you are as an investor, whether this investment is right for you, and how you should proceed going forward. So I think that's a great way for our listeners and viewers to sometimes look at investments.
Yep, I agree.
Moving on to Rule 15. In every industry and every region of the country, the observant amateur can find great growth companies long before the professionals have discovered them. This is a shorter one, but what's your initial thought on this one, Roshan?
Yeah, and I think this goes back to what Peter Lynch said, invest in what you know. So where are you spending your money? What stores are you going to? In his book that really got us down this this path, Beating the Street, which I believe that's Lynch's second book, he says something to the effect of the mall can be better than an investment conference, and how he would like to go to the mall and just see where people shop, so they can see where the opportunities are. And I can think of historically some real life experiences I have. Now, I did not invest in any of these things at the time, but where, you know, one of Peter's principle would have proven to be a good investment move. The first comes back to when this was back when I was an intern. I was still in school, and Abercrombie and Fitch was taking off. And I think this is not a great rule for me personally, because the mall is one of my least favorite places in the world. I avoid the mall as much as possible. I hate the mall. But back then, people were, you know, this is in the mid to late 90s, people were buying from Abercrombie and Fitch, and the stock was taking off. And I remember in the office as an intern hearing people say that the fundamentals and numbers didn't work, and it was taking off. But if you had a teenager that liked to shop at the time, you would have seen that Abercrombie was very popular. I don't know that it is or that it isn't, or whether it is or isn't a good deal now, but that's one. The other that comes to mind is this was probably back in, I'd say probably in 2009, 2010, something similar was happening with Lululemon stock. You know, not just the stock, but the stores. Stores were expanding. People were buying Lululemon clothing. You know, yoga wear at leisure was taking off, and Lululemon was a premium seller in that space. So, I don't know if that's an opportunity now, but these are just two examples that come to mind of finding great growth companies before the professional by just seeing what's around you and where really, where are you spending your money? Are there things you find you're spending more of your money on now than before? And are those trends you can take advantage of from an investment perspective? This is another example that I didn't invest, but Amazon's another one. I found that roughly 12 years ago, and I should just for fun, look at the price of Amazon. But that's when I first did a subscribe and save because my oldest now, Dylan, was born, and we were buying diapers on subscribe and save. And then gradually, Amazon started getting more and more of our money. These are all examples of retail stores, and I'm looking at right now. It says that had I bought it then in 2012, I could have got it. This is December 31st, but at $12.54, it's now over $185. So had I just followed my wallet and where my money was going, you know, following one of these Peter Lynch rules, it would have proven profitable. So maybe I need to spend a little bit more time on that. Where am I spending my money? And then extrapolating that to what are some good investment opportunities or ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. And we talked about this before, how this is going to be different for everybody because different people use different products and services. What you may use on a daily basis, somebody else may not use. And the key here to this rule is observant, where you have to be observant the products and services that you're using to see, hey, is there an opportunity here? Is this an investment opportunity? Where somebody that doesn't use that products and services may not see it, but for what they're using, there might be an alternative for them. So I definitely like having that discussion and pointing that out because, you know, it's showing the amateur versus the professional where you think, hey, the professional always has the advantage. They have all the information out there, where sometimes that might not be the case.
Yeah. And you know, I'll tell you, there's one that I looked at often because of my own personal spending habits and, it's never been cheap enough, but like McDonald's, it's the only thing close by to the office for lunch. So when I would go there, when I do go there, still not like it was only in the past, but I will, always feel like, well, if I own the stock, I feel like I'd be getting some of my, spend back, but, McDonald's has never really quite been cheap enough. That being said, I'd have to look at what that's done investment wise, but I'd be surprised if it wouldn't have done well had I just bought some of that. But yep, that's a good one. I don't think I'm the best person for that rule. Not only with my examples of not taking advantage of it, but when I talked about not liking the mall, I think Lynch would see a lot there. Maybe today a lot of that can be online. Like with, I've heard, Temu and then Shein are places people will buy online now a lot. But once again, I don't use those. So I don't have personal experience as a customer for those places.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess like the only warning I would give our listeners and viewers is just, you got to be careful with your biases when it comes to that, because that could be a big thing where you're using this product or this service and you're like, I use it every day. I think they're a great company because it's a big part of my life. Therefore, I should invest in the stock and therefore the stock price will do well. That's sometimes just not the case. And that's something you always got to be aware of because that can be a certain pitfall for investors out there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's where, coming back, I think that McDonald's example I gave is a really good one, Adrian, for what mm-hmm. you just described, because yes. It's not that I didn't look, with the other three, the Amazon, the Lululemon, and the Abercrombie & Fitch, I didn't look at all. With McDonald's, that the idea came to me. I'm going there all the time. And I saw them expanding into the coffee space and so on. So I kind of saw the opportunity. I did look, and it just wasn't cheap enough. Maybe I should have dug deeper in it. But you bring up a great point. Don't just buy because you like it. That should be the starting point for your research and analysis.
Yeah, exactly. Moving on to rule 16. A stock market decline is as routine as a January blizzard in Colorado. If you are prepared, it can't hurt you. A decline is a great opportunity to pick up the bargains left behind by investors who are fleeing the storm in panic.
Yes. Great one. You should not, he mentions being prepared. You should expect and be prepared for it. Now, what do those two things mean? Expect it, know that it's going to decline. You're not going to be able to predict when. It's just it's going to happen. And Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan, even major, you know, crashes and declines, you can't predict. If we take, we look at recent history, there's no predictors for COVID, right? Like, I guess you could have argued that if you researched it and saw the news in October, you could have protected your portfolio and been out by March. I actually only know of one well-known investment manager, Bill Ackman, who did that. So the majority of the world did not do that. So you couldn't have predicted it, and the markets declined. Continuing on from that, they then recovered, and then they declined because of inflation. Now, looking back, I think that one was a lot predictable, but the reason I say it the way I did is because I did not make significant adjustments in anticipation of the inflation. I'll tell you, I will if we have any kind of similar scenario again, but I did not, and I know of many that didn't. And at the time, the Fed, who's supposed to be our country's experts on stuff like this, they were saying it's transitory, meaning it'll come and go. Right. And I remember arguing on our podcast with Eric that, you know, I didn't believe it's transitory because I don't think companies would bring down the pricing. Now, my rationale has not been proven correct. Now, that's not the reason that it has not been transitory, but the outcome that it wasn't transitory is accurate. So had I taken my thesis and actually acted on it, I think the outcome of that decline, I think we would have held up stronger. So going back to what he had said, a decline will happen. You won't exactly know why. You've got to be prepared for it. To me, being prepared for it is in a couple ways. The first is mentally prepared for it. Right? I mentioned moments ago, for me, being mentally prepared means I've done my homework on the stocks. Right. So the other thing I'd say is being financially prepared for it. And one way you're financially prepared is making sure your investments line up with your time frame. If you need money to buy a house in 6 months or a year, shouldn't be in stocks, right? And once again, this isn't advice. This is just a conversation here. Feel free to reach out to us if you need advice. But in general, if it's a short-term goal, you know, you don't put the money you need for 6 months in a house in stocks or for your kids' education. You know, it's January, they're going to school in September to college, and you've got to write that check. You've got the money in the investment account. That shouldn't be in stocks. Or if it's in the 529, you should, you know, gradually, you know, pull that out of investments, because you don't want the market decline to dictate those things. So the way to be prepared first is, I mentioned, mentally you expect it, you've done the homework, you don't have your short-term money in stocks because you want the time frame for it to recover. The last point I'll mention is having cash or dry powder, as Buffett puts it. You need to have cash available to invest when the opportunity arises. And what amount of cash you've got, you know, is really up to you and your portfolio and what makes sense. But we would always tell people, have cash for emergencies or opportunities. And if you view the decline as expected, then just get ready to take advantage of that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And what you mentioned leads well into Rule 17. And this is, everyone has the brain power to make money in stocks. Not everyone has the stomach. If you are susceptible to selling everything in a panic, you ought to avoid stocks and stock mutual funds altogether. So this really points out about investors, you know, are able to diversify, invest in companies, and really ride the wave of the market if they're going up. However, if the markets aren't going up and they don't have the stomach for that, then it can be a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I was just, I'm in the middle of David Rubenstein's book. And he says in here that something to the effect of, if you're a genius in one field, that doesn't necessarily translate to being a genius in investing. And to me, this Lynch quote lines up with that very well, because as he said, you can have the brain power, but you've also got to have the stomach, right? And that's what I've been talking about, is being comfortable with the volatility. The rule before, just saying it will, you know, the markets will go down. And I said earlier, if you concentrate your portfolio, as Lynch mentioned, it's going to jump around up and down a lot more. And you've just got to accept that as a truism. And if you can't deal with the volatility, and exactly as he says, if you're susceptible to selling in a panic, so if a market decline makes you scared and you're like, hey, I've got to sell, I want to go to cash, well, then you shouldn't be buying that stock, index, whatever it is, anyway, if you're going to have that panic. If you're the person that has the panic, you're the person that we're trying to buy from in Rule 16, when it says be prepared. And I had said be prepared to take advantage of a market decline. What you're doing when you take advantage of a market decline is you're buying from people who are panic selling. So you don't want to be the panic seller. I'll tell clients this all the time, where I never want to put you in a position to be a forced seller. That's someone that has to sell for a reason. So on the rule before, when I gave the example of it's January, your child's going to college in September, and you've got to pay that college bill, that bill's going to be there. And let's just say this money is the only money you have to pay for college. You can't go anywhere else for it but this one pot of money. If that pot of money's in stocks, and between January and September, the stock market drops 40%, you are a forced seller. You need this money. You have no other options. You've got to sell and take that 40% loss. Other examples of forced sellers are people that will be buying and selling on margin, right? That margin means you're taking a loan to buy stocks. If the markets decline significantly, you must sell those stocks to repay that loan. And in some places, you can come up with cash elsewhere and you don't have to sell. In other places, they're just going to sell for you. There's nothing you can do. You can really do about it. So I would just, going back to this rule of everyone's got the brain power, but not the stomach for it. The stomach is just, can you mentally deal with the volatility? But I just gave you some examples of cases where even if you can mentally deal with it, you'd be forced out, and you never want to be that. We'll discuss this a little bit more in depth in one of the upcoming rules, where he talks about Peter Lynch talks about options. So we'll come back to this, you know, forced seller conversation. But for this rule in particular, knowing yourself and what gives you the temperament to hold in a decline is important, because you want to make sure you only invest in the area where you have the temperament to hold.
Yeah, exactly. Identify the type of investor you are. I think that's very key here, where that can guide your investment decisions and put you in the best position that you see fit. So moving on to rule 18, there is always something to worry about. Avoid weekend thinking and ignore the latest dire predictions of the newscasters. Sell a stock because the company's fundamentals deteriorate, not because the sky is falling. And the way I really just describe this rule as just, you know, blocking out all the noise and focusing on what fits for you and what your situation is going through right now.
Yeah, and this is a great one, right? And I feel like I say this after most of these rules. I'm definitely a fan of the rules and Peter Lynch, and you know, his phenomenal track record speaks for itself. You know, well over 20% returns while he had his portfolio. But here, if nothing changes with the business and the market's down, that's just the market that's changed, but not the business. So there's nothing you have to do. And this decline in stock price could present you a buying opportunity. But to be clear on that, I made a note of this while I was preparing for this. Not all declines are buying opportunities. And I have not only a specific example, but I have a specific friend in mind when I think about this. I've got a friend that will buy and sell stocks. And he's always talking about using literally jargon. I don't exactly know because it's for lack of a better term, it's Twitter, Reddit, trader type jargon. And he'll constantly talk about buying to lower his cost basis because it's down, or buying the dip. And he'll talk about what a stock price has done, but not what the company's doing. And I know he's got a mixed bag of results. I don't know whether he's making money or losing money, but every time he talks about stocks, I get worried about what he's doing with his money, just because what he's doing sounds like gambling, not investing. And that's where the concern for me lies. How this connects with this rule is, first, don't sell because the stock's down. You only sell if the fundamentals of the business have deteriorated, if something's changed with your investment thesis. And this, we're all talking about if it's gone down. If it's gone up, it's the same thing, right? Has the thesis changed? Has the company gone beyond what you think is a good price? But when we're talking about the downside, if the price went down, it may present a buying opportunity. Before you jump in and buy because of a decline, though, I think this is an opportunity to do your homework again, just to make sure nothing's changed with the business fundamentals, with your thesis, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this leads right into Rule 19. Nobody can predict interest rates, the future direction of the economy, or the stock market. Dismiss all such forecasts and concentrate on what actually happening to the companies in which you have invested in. With that, were you talking about that friend who's really just looking at this price and the momentum or whatever it is to do with the stock, not actually the company? I think that really plays right into this rule.
It definitely does. And to be honest, I don't know what he's looking at, right? You know, it's just, it's not indiscriminate buying and selling. I shouldn't say I don't know what he's looking at. I know he's doing online research and chat rooms and things like that, but not necessarily the companies. But with this rule, what I love about this rule is if you eliminate the time spent on, and I'm just going to read what he predicted, what he wrote, excuse me. If you eliminate your time and effort spent on looking at what people are saying interest rates are doing, what people are saying the economy is doing, what people are saying the markets are doing as a whole, and by people, I mean industry experts, talking heads, et cetera, and forecasts, and just spend your time researching the companies, I think by eliminating the time on those things, you will free up a lot of time. A lot of the noise in the that's out there on the markets are these things: predictions of rates, economy, where the market's going to go. And I have been, fallen victim of this many times, where I've looked at it and I wish I could get all that time back. I pledge to not fall victim to this going forward. But I do also think looking for comfort in some of these things goes back to one of the previous rules of doing your homework. You know, what we discussed, doing your homework so you're comfortable with the market decline. I think a lot of times you're looking at these predictions or directions or looking at things from the market. It's when the market's down and you're looking for some hope or someone that will give you some information that lines up with your thought, right? And to make you feel better, you're looking at these things. But I really do like Lynch saying, don't waste your time on it. Don't look into it. Buffett's got a statement or a quote that's something to the effect of, if I knew which way the Fed was going to do with the rates, it wouldn't matter. I would still do the same thing that he's doing investment-wise. So if you are looking at, Lynch was a stock picker, so we're really talking to stock pickers out there. If you're not a stock picker and don't want to be, I still think these rules are helpful to you. And the help may be in, I don't want to do all these things. Let me just get an index.
Yeah, and I think the word you're looking for is confirmation, where if the market is going up and you're participating in that, you're looking for anything out there that confirms why you're right and why the market's going up. And vice versa, if the market's going down, you want to confirm something out there on why it's going down, just to help with your decision making.
Yeah, and I appreciate you using that word, you know, that I was looking for, because that leads me to one of the behavioral finance things, which is confirmation bias, right? You have a bias, you're looking for a narrative, a talking head, a prediction, a story that lines up with that bias, right? You're not necessarily, and that'll make you feel better with what you have. You aren't necessarily looking at it completely with an open mind. So avoid the confirmation bias, avoid creating those echo chambers where you're just hearing, you know, what you want to hear, because, and you're eliminating those because you're not looking for any of that stuff at all. You're avoiding that information on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Rule 20, if you study 10 companies, you'll find one for which the story is better than expected. If you study 50, you'll find five. There are always pleasant surprises to be found in the stock market. Companies whose achievements are being overlooked on Wall Street. And I think this one is, if you broaden your investment horizon, you can always find opportunity. However, that does require a lot more homework and research. And if you have the time for it, great. But if you don't, it can sort of be overwhelming sometimes, don't you think, Roshan?
Yeah, it definitely can be. And yeah, Peter Lynch was known to be constantly working. He would plan his vacations around visiting companies. So he was always looking for those investment opportunities, always researching, constantly working. And you may not want to do that. You know, if you don't want to do that, and that's the kind of portfolio you want, you find a professional that will do that for you, or you just look at the index. I wonder, though, if his I question the number. I think it's actually lower. I think if you study 10 companies, I don't know that you'll actually find one, right? I think that the numbers are lower, the opportunities are fewer and far between. But that also depends on the market environment, right? When the markets are down and everyone's scared, there's a blood in the streets, so to speak, there are more opportunities then. I can't give credit to who said this, but I had read once that if you find four good investments in a year, that's a good year. And I think that is probably more in line than the 1 to 10 or 5 to 50 that Lynch said. But in general, I do agree with the sentiment here.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, great. Moving on to Rule 21: if you don't study any companies, you have the same success buying stocks as you do in a poker game if you bet without looking at your cards. So I think this lines up again with that friend that you mentioned. I don't want to feel like we're picking on him, but again, they mentioned poker game in this rule, which lines up with gambling. And that's something that you mentioned.
Well, if he's listening, he knows how I feel. I've told him this of my concern. Right. So we're not picking on him, and he's not hearing it for the first time. But yes, I do like this. And the reason I think the poker game is a really good analogy without looking at your cards, and yeah, it goes back to the David Rubenstein book that I'm listening to as well. It's called that book's called How to Invest. I just started on it. Let's see how it goes. But we'll definitely share information on this podcast and maybe do an episode on it. Or he talks to multiple investors, so maybe we'll do multiple episodes on it as we go through it. But if you don't study the company, just like not looking at your cards in poker, you may get lucky, right? That happens, right? You may get lucky, but your success is based on luck. And nobody that is consistently successful with investing gets there because of luck. And in the book, where the book lines up directly with this is he talks about getting lucky as an investor sometimes is not a good thing, because if particularly if it's earlier on in your career, because what can happen then is you get lucky, you make a little bit of money, and then the next time you do something similar, typically that's with more capital at risk, you don't get lucky and you lose. And luck does happen in investing. However, getting lucky won't get there consistently. And just, you know, as we talk about this, another, yeah, I'm a Thomas Jefferson fan. I love some of his quotes, but his quote is, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. And that's where I think your luck is going to happen with effort. Yeah, and it does make me think of investments I've made in the past where I've done the full due diligence and my thesis was right, but I got lucky along the way. Not that it was wrong, but you know, I think of two things come to mind. You know, just with recent history. One is when I'd gotten to housing stocks as interest rates were going up and the markets hated them because markets, you know, interest rates are going up, people are going to buy less houses, don't get in the housing stocks was the thought. I looked at the shortage of housing and I thought, rates are going to go up, but people still need houses, the markets are down, but if you're given a long time horizon, there's a great opportunity to buy. That's the way I viewed it. The luck aspect came because what actually happened is there was less supply because sellers didn't want to get rid of a low interest rate, which gave more these builders, particularly builders that own their mortgage companies, a greater opportunity. So, you know, the luck for me, when I share that story, to me, the lucky part was the timing. The thesis happened a lot faster than I expected because of that. And the luck wasn't that the fundamentals or I just bought and it happened to go up or anything like that. It was, and where that Jefferson quotes comes in is I spend a lot of work researching, analyzing, and you know, going back to Lynch's rule, feeling comfortable with owning that, knowing that as I bought, it could continue to go down because I was a long-term investor caught in short-term focus with interest rates in the stocks that are, you know, right at the heart of this. They're significantly affected by this. So that's just an example of the luck. Adrian, any thoughts on that, or we can continue on to the next rule?
Yeah, we can continue on. I think those are all great examples that really highlight what this rule is trying to show. So rule 22, time is on your side when you own shares of a superior companies. You can afford to be patient even if you missed Walmart in the first 5 years. It was a great stock to own in the next 5 years. Time is against you when you own options. And this is the option ones that you were referring to earlier on in the podcast, Roshan.
Yes, it was. And you know, this is a great one. First, I believe I've shared this before. I couldn't tell you what episode, but I view time as your edge as an investor, right? So when you're investing or you research investing, you'll constantly hear people talk about, well, what's your edge? And most and your edge is being something that you have, know, or do that's better than someone else. So for example, going back to Lynch's rule about you can find a growth company first. Well, your edge at the mall is you're a consumer and you see where people are buying, right? Whereas you compare, and you're seeing that right now in real time. Whereas the investors that are not going to the mall and are just waiting for the stock reports, et cetera, they're getting all the information a quarter delayed, and they're not seeing the frenzy with the buying, right? So your edge in that situation is you've gone to the mall and you see where people are going, and then once again you do your research after that as well. Well, what I think a lot of individual investors have, you know, the clients we work with, the people listening, is time. Time is your edge. A lot of the research analysis, time and effort on those things in the professional world is spent focusing on short term. And if you focus on the long term, that's where it creates your opportunity. The housing stock was a great example, right? I didn't know these things were going to move in the short term. I'm just looking at the long-term fundamentals that we have a shortage of housing. The stock's cheap. I liked how they were managed. I researched the company and all right, let's buy there. But the edge there is timing. Time. Having a time horizon to see through the what's going on now. You know, using the colloquialism, you're seeing the forest for forest versus the trees, right? Seeing the forest, not the trees here. So time, as he says, is on your side when you own superior companies. Well, if you have a good company that's run well, that's efficient, that's you know, doing a good job for their customers, that company is going to continue to grow, continue to expand, continue to build revenue. So the longer you own it, the better you are. You know, I've said this before, and I stole this from Buffett, but the ideal time horizon is forever. If you find a good company, why would you sell if all the fundamentals are still there? So that's the first part of this statement. The next one is time is against you when you own options. Well, and I've learned this lesson the hard way. I've shared this story before. I invested a significant amount of money for me in a stock, and I as the price went down, I bought more. As the price went further down, I then shifted to options to have more leverage. Well, by shifting the options, I put myself on a clock, and I still tell you these options expired in January of 2023. Had they not expired in January of 2023, or had I owned the stock, I was right. I was just right in March of 2023. So my investment went to zero. I got nothing because I was off by 2 months. And this is where I think the valuable lesson of buying options comes into play. And my lesson, I will never do that again, is the terminology I use. I don't ever want to put myself on a clock. So if you're buying the options, you've got to be right about your investment thesis, and you've got to be right about the timing of it coming through, and you've got to be right about the market reaction to your thesis being correct. So if you're right about everything, earnings go up and so on, but we're in an environment that we were a couple of years ago that rates are going up, maybe you're right about everything, but what's going on with the company, but what's going on with the overall economy delays that outcome. So I would caution against options, encourage you to do your homework. As we always say, this is not investment advice. Talk to a professional, but I think this is a very valuable rule, and it helps people. If it helps people avoid putting themselves on a clock by, you know, buying these options, this could arguably be the one of the most important rules on there. Once again, if you buy a stock, you just got to be right about your what happens, and you've got theoretically an unlimited time frame for it to come to fruition, assuming the company doesn't go out of business. Whereas if you've got an option, you've got to be right, and you've got to get the timing right. It makes it a lot more difficult, or said differently, a lot more can go wrong in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot more to consider too. That's the only thing I'd add to that.
Makes you a forced seller or forced to get out of your position, which, as I said earlier, that's the worst position to be in. You don't want to be a forced seller.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Rule 23, if you have the stomach for stocks, but neither the time nor the inclination to do the homework, invest in equity mutual funds. Here is a good idea to diversify. You should own a few different kinds of funds with managers who pursue different styles of investing, growth, value, small companies, large companies, etc. Investing the six of the same kind of fund is not diversification.
Yeah, a good rule here. I've mentioned this a few times. If you don't want to do the research, don't feel comfortable with the volatility of the stocks, you know, just get an index. Here, Lynch is saying the same thing, except he's saying just get, you know, equity mutual funds. You've got exchange traded funds available now as well. So there's a ton of options in here. And he talks about a lot of different stock funds in here. In this book, Beating the Street, he spends the first few chapters just talking about investing in stocks versus bonds. And so I think that's why he's not including this in here with diversification. But I really like that last sentence, investing in six of the same kind of funds is not diversification. I see this mistake very frequently. We'll have someone come in the office and they'll have, you know, multiple 401ks, multiple IRAs. And then when you actually, and a lot of different funds in all of them with different names. But when you look at all of them, they're all large U.S. stock funds, and that's it. So they own the same things. It's just a different place, different name, but it's still the same thing. So I really like that last sentence of investing in the same kind of fund is not diversification.
Yeah, a good point. Another good example I like is, it's just a common example you see where you think of a diversification, you got to look a lot more into it, where somebody could says, hey, I own stock A and B, C, D, E. And if you look at all five of those stocks, you can see that they're all in the energy sector or the energy industry. Even though, yes, you know, you think technically, hey, I'm diversified because I own five different companies. Well, in all actuality, if that industry or that sector gets impacted, you can see all those other companies get impacted, and you can see a negative result. Even though you think diversifying is a way to protect you, you have to dig a little bit deeper and expand more on it than just that.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed.
Rule 24, among the major stock markets of the world, the U.S. market ranks eighth in total return over the past decade. You can take advantage of the faster growing economies by investing some portion of your assets in an overseas fund with a good record.
Yeah, once again, another one that makes sense. This is just look in other countries, and it's just another thing to his to the diversification point we touched on earlier. You know, it would be diversify to look and invest abroad. I don't necessarily think he's looking to say diversification here. If you remember, one of the previous rules was actually about concentrating, rule number 14 when we started off. I think he's just saying here, you don't just have to look in the U.S. You can look anywhere in the world.
Yeah. And preparing for this podcast, I was surprised because I thought the U.S. market would rank a lot higher than eighth in total return. I'm trying to do a little bit more research to see where he came up with that number. But did you find anything on that, Roshan?
Well, no. But remember, this book was published in the 90s. Right. I think it was published in the 90s. So the information is definitely dated. So I'm sure the rank would be different, but I did not dig any deeper into what the answer would be now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's something that I guess we'll look more into. And I'm just curious and see what the data is on that. But I'll move on to the last rule for now. Yep. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Adrian. Well, it was in 93.
Okay.
So I think he's probably talking about the 80s when he talks about the, or maybe 83 to 93 when he talks about the past decade. But I do think that is old information.
Yeah. I mean, if you told me to guess, even in the 80s and 90s, I still would have said the U.S. would at least be in the top three. So when I saw the eighth one, I was surprised. Maybe I'm biased because I obviously live in the country. But yeah, I guess I'm curious to look more into that.
Yeah. That would be definitely be worthwhile.
So rule 25, in the long run, a portfolio of well-chosen stocks and or equity mutual funds will always outperform a portfolio of bonds or a money market account. In the long run, a portfolio of poorly chosen stocks won't outperform the money left under the mattress. A classic example, money under mattress, you can't lose anything, but you can't gain anything.
Yep. And, here, I think it goes back to what Lynch said earlier, which is, you know, in Rule 23. He said, if you don't have the stomach for stocks or the inclination to do the homework, invest in funds. I think this lines up with that, too. If you don't have the time, energy, interest to look into stocks and you want a stock-driven portfolio, find someone professional who you can work with that does have that and will find it for you, or you can look at the indexes, or as Lynch says, look under the mattress or leave it under the mattress versus selecting the bad stocks. But remember, as I mentioned earlier, he spends a lot of time in the beginning of the book just being an advocate for investing in stocks versus bonds. And I think that needing to take that stance is a little dated. What I mean by that is I don't think if you compare it back to the 80s in particular, people were looking at really high interest rates and stocks were at single digit PEs. So people were definitely more inclined for bonds then. And Peter Lynch was a bond fund manager, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, bond fund. He was a stock fund manager. And I think here he's just advocating for, hey, you know, invest in stocks. They'll do better than bonds over the long run. I don't think that position necessarily needs to be taken in 2024.
Yeah. And I guess I'll have to correct myself, because if there's any economists listening to this, I said, if your money's under the mattress, you can't lose anything. But an economist would be like, what about inflation? Are you kidding me, Adrian? You're losing every day to that. What are you talking about? So I guess that's the only point I'll make.
Yeah. And I think Lynch isn't comparing it to inflation. He's just, and maybe it's a little tongue in cheek here, but he's just saying that, don't buy a bunch of poorly chosen stocks. And for him, a poorly chosen stock is a stock you haven't done the homework on, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that's what he's really talking about here. You don't buy stocks that you haven't done your homework on, mm-hmm. and you've always got the option in rule 23 of buying the fund. So if you're not doing the homework on stocks, have someone else do the homework, or just get indexes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, we went through all the rules. Are there any final thoughts or anything that you want to add?
No, I thought this was great. If anyone out there listening needs help or wants to go over, has questions on the rules, wants to go over them a little more in depth, please reach out to us. You've got our information. Adrian, did you have anything that stood out that you particularly liked or didn't like with this? I personally found this exercise very, very helpful.
No, I did as well, Roshan. I mean, you're talking about 25 rules that we talked about. We had to split it up in two episodes. A lot of information, a lot of content here that I think, may apply to some people, may not. But overall, I think it's just a great way to help you just become a better investor.
Yeah, I definitely think it is. I think it is. And for everyone listening, thanks for joining us. We'll be back with another great episode in 1 to 2 weeks to take control and achieve your goals.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through RHA Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither RHA Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of RHA Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through RHA Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor, and securities through RHA Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance by Jason Shaw in Audionautix. It's part of the YouTube Audio Library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.